It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer. Kent, as part of our ongoing conversations about how to reduce housing insecurity in Wisconsin, we turn to Brown County with Lydia Van Thiel, Project Implementation Director for the Greater Green Bay Blueprint to Prevent and End Homelessness. And this plan underway contains strategies and actions and tasks. Lydia also leads the Service Providers Committee within the Brown County Homeless and Housing Coalition. You can join the discussion at any point. Call in with a question or comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Lydia, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, turning to last year, more than 550 people experiencing homelessness in Brown County, according to the Point in Time survey from the Institute for Community Alliances. What is driving the growth?
Yeah, so I mean, I think we know that the lack of affordable housing nationwide, but very much locally as well. This has been going on for a while, but is significantly growing and impacting communities all over. The impacts of COVID are definitely impacting this as well. So we're seeing the effects of mental health and social isolation are still trickling down from COVID, and you know, the rising costs of living and wages are really largely just staying the same, and so people are having to make up that income gap. Pandemic financial aid and eviction moratoriums have ended, but they weren't really addressing the root causes, and a lot of people were racking up past due rent in the eviction moratorium ended, and so a lot of people were getting evicted because of that. So really the impacts of COVID are a huge piece of things. Mental health and addiction are obviously big impacts as well, but really it comes down to this lack of real affordable realistic housing for our community members that are lower income.
And we're going to turn to housing in a moment in what you set out to do in Brown County. But I want to first look at the shelter situation. Brown County having three emergency shelters to support the homeless population. Are shelters in the region accessible? And how are they doing?
Yeah. So definitely, you know, the need for low barrier shelters is really important in our communities. Having shelters be available regardless of whether or not somebody is struggling through an addiction or maybe has a criminal past. And so wanting to ensure that we're getting people off the streets and into services and into ultimately housing is number one. So definitely locally, we're seeing that shelters are struggling with longer wait lists, and people are staying in shelters longer than they were in the past because of this blockage of affordable housing or accessible housing for them. And so with that in mind, people are staying longer. Shelters aren't opening up as much as they were in the past. And so those wait lists are getting longer. People are sleeping in their vehicles or out on the streets a little bit longer than they may have in the past. So,
do you mean wait lists to be able to access a shelter, like running out of space?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. So we have one locally in Green Bay here. We have one shelter of last resort, which is open November through end of April. So it is open right now, and they do not turn people away. They don't have a capacity, and that's St. John's Ministries. And so the other shelters in the area are full at capacity, and those are year-round shelters.
We're talking about Green Bay's approach to address homelessness. Lydia Van Thiel with us, Project Implementation Director for the Greater Green Bay Blueprint to Prevent and End Homelessness. You can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Green Bay is in year two of this five-year action plan to address homelessness. Which key strategies do you see underway to improve and expand shelter services first?
Yeah, that's a great question. So We have been working hard at trying to accomplish as many tasks in the blueprint as possible. There are five strategies, and about within those strategies are 98 tasks. So it is quite comprehensive. And with that being said, we are trying to pull the work forward. So some things that have been done locally, we have the Brown County Housing Authority and Integrated Community Solutions have incentivized landlords to participate in the Section 8 Housing Choice Voucher Program by offering landlords a chunk of money to essentially rent to people with those vouchers. And so that has really been moving the work forward in that realm, and building relationships with landlords has been really important for us in the last couple of years, listening to landlords and what they're needing. And so that program alone has had 43 new landlords in the past 11 months sign on to Housing Choice Vouchers, which is really exciting. Brown County has also provided the Brown County Homeless and Housing Coalition with $20,000 in ARPA grants to be able to provide people with lived experience, people experiencing homelessness with IDs, identification, mm-hmm. birth certificates, photo IDs, driver's license, to be able to help them quicker access housing. So definitely trying to work towards some of the different strategies, working on building relationships and trying to create some longer lasting collaborations and networks with other sectors, including healthcare, employment services, law enforcement, and really trying to build this larger system of care network.
So with five strategies, nearly 100 tasks, has this blueprint, is it being implemented in the way you envisioned, in the way you thought it would?
Yeah, that's so Corporation for Supportive Housing is a national organization, and they came into the community in 2020 and 2021 to help us put the blueprint together. So they did put the blueprint and put it together in a way that suggested how we could get the blueprint implemented. Now, it didn't work out exactly for our community. And so we are in the process of kind of reassessing what that looks like specifically for our community and our local coalition. And so we're reassessing different work groups and players on how we can get the work done and who needs to be engaged into the work in order to ensure that we actually do complete some of those strategies within the blueprint. So we are in the midst of kind of reassessing and realigning some of this work right now. Part of the goal is to create some work groups, and part of it is organizations are just taking on some of those strategies that align with their mission and align with their organizational goals and are just moving the work forward on their own.
Are there any tasks in the blueprint that could be considered complete that you have checked off?
Yeah, some of those strategies I mentioned earlier with mm-hmm. The Housing Authority offering incentives to landlords and building relationships with landlords. Those that ARPA dollars for providing people experiencing homelessness with IDs and identifications. We also have one task that is increase culturally inclusive childcare into the community, and our Brown County United Way, COMSA, and Family and Child Care Resources of Northeast Wisconsin partnered to create a training program for our Somali population on becoming certified child care instructors. And so that they're looking to develop that too more into working with the Hispanic population. So there are definitely a few tasks that we've accomplished, and some of them are small in just terms of bringing a group of people together and having conversations or educating service providers on the Green Bay Metro system. And so some of those things are definitely easy to accomplish, and some of them are a little bit more intensive and are going to take a little bit longer to accomplish. But we accomplished about, I would say, 20 to 25 tasks have been complete. And so we're just moving forward. And also work begets more work. So
Work
some of
begets
those,
more work. Yes.
yes. So some of those tasks we complete, and then we'll
It
have to
opens
continue.
new doors. Yes. Lydia
Yes.
Van Thiel is with the Brown County Homeless and Housing Coalition and Project Implementation Director for the Greater Green Bay Blueprint to Prevent and End Homelessness. Be part of this conversation. Call in with a question. Share your perspective. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The greater Green Bay area went through a planning process a few years ago and published a blueprint in 2021 with strategies, actions, and tasks aimed at solving homelessness in the region. We learn about that plan with Lydia Van Thiel, Project Implementation Director of the Greater Green Bay Blueprint to Prevent and End Homelessness. And you can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Lydia, we heard from Nina in Menasha called in to say that their nephew's rent was recently raised from $800 a month to $1,300 a month when the building was bought by another company. And Nina is concerned that such steep rate hikes could result in homelessness and wonders if there is perhaps a legal recourse for renters in a situation like this.
Yeah, that is that's happening all over, and those larger companies are coming in, and sometimes even out of state companies coming in and buying up rental properties, and it's really very concerning, and definitely is impacting people and driving up our homeless numbers. So now there definitely is some thoughts about, you know, reaching out to fair housing and that sort of thing, but unfortunately there is really some restrictions on what renters can do, and so it is impacting people, and unfortunately there's not a ton of recourse that renters have.
Okay, Nina, thank you so much for contributing that. The Brown County Homeless and Housing Coalition is working to create a fair chance housing ordinance in Green Bay and Brown County. What is this?
Yeah, so a fair chance housing ordinance is listed in the blueprint and is something that we haven't really addressed here directly, but essentially that is ensuring that people with criminal backgrounds have access to housing in the same way. So that others do. And so we really haven't gotten to the nitty gritty locally on how we're going to try to address that, but it really will take some legislative advocacy and partners working together to try to pass an ordinance like that, whether it's locally or potentially even statewide.
Let's bring on Tim in Hollandale. Tim, hi. What would you like to share?
This country needs to pay its labor force a livable wage. We've been catering to the rich for over 20 years. There's a thing in this country called the working homeless. If you have a job, you should not be homeless. This country has gotten to a point where we need to do something or it's going to break, and for sure, we will lose the number one spot if we destroy what's left of our labor force, which is pretty much already decimated.
Tim, thank you for calling in. Lydia, what do you make of that sentiment?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. People are really struggling, living paycheck to paycheck without having or being able to build a savings. It's really easy to fall into homelessness. And there are a lot, I mean, the misconception is that people experiencing homelessness are not working, but that's just not true. A lot of them are working, but they're not getting paid enough to be able to save up for security deposit and first month's rent and all of those costs that come with getting into housing and be able to sustain themselves and the housing with the way the rent prices are. So that's definitely a huge concern.
the blueprint says that more than 6,100 rental units are needed by 2040 to fit the needs of low-income residents in the Green Bay region. What does the blueprint call for in creating that influx of new units?
Yeah, so part of the strategies within the blueprint suggest to find new and innovative ways to build housing in general, but especially affordable housing. And so trying to utilize the tax increment financing, affordable housing extension, and looking at restructuring debt on existing multifamily properties, and some of those kinds of unique ways to look at what we're doing. Building housing is very expensive already, but building affordable housing is even more difficult. So you have to access some of those WIDA tax credits and tax grants, and it becomes very difficult to build. And so definitely within the city of Green Bay and locally, we're trying to find innovative ways to make that happen.
I imagine that's the crux, right? Because the new housing, it's new housing, and it has to be affordable enough for people who are trying to stabilize their life after homelessness. So that is tricky in order to set that rent amount.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was just going to mention, we talked with Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson, joined us recently to discuss their housing first approach. And the mayor said the program supports people who are prone to housing insecurity due to struggles with substance use.
If you pair housing with them first, it puts them in a better position to be able to overcome those challenges that they have and not go back into a situation where they find themselves to be unhoused.
Lydia, what are you looking toward in Milwaukee's practices that you might want to apply in the Green Bay area?
Great question. So we are trying to build permanent supportive housing here locally. One of the projects that that we actually have talked with Milwaukee about in terms of their Autumn West program, which they operate as a safe haven, we are looking to develop something similar, which is peer-run housing. And that specifically is trying to address the chronic homeless population. And that would be people with mental health or addiction issues that are really pervasive and really then are causing struggles for them to be able to even access shelter, congregate living shelters. And so we're trying to put something like that together, which would be peer-run support. So it would be certified peer specialists kind of operating the programming and building those relationships with people experiencing homelessness to help them move forward. The goal would be that it's a single room occupancy, so they have their own space. They don't have to be in this large room full of people, which hopefully if they have some significant mental health issues will really help them be able to stabilize and self-actualize. And so that is kind of one of the big things that we've been kind of having conversations with Milwaukee and their Autumn West program and how we could develop something like that here. And we also really want permanent supportive housing projects locally, and have been a few organizations, a few nonprofits are really looking into how we can make that happen.
In our last moments together, as we look at the greater Green Bay Blueprint to Prevent and End Homelessness as a document, a living document, I should say, Lydia, I wonder just what are the ongoing conversations like, and how will the blueprint be revisited and updated to address changing needs in your region?
Yeah, we have been having conversations, like I said, about how we can realign and reassess some of the work that we've been doing. So we do have a few work groups already meeting. One is around working with landlords and trying to build tenant trainings and landlord trainings, and ultimately create a landlord risk mitigation fund. Which would be able to provide landlords with a sense of security in renting to people with barriers. So we're headed in the right direction in terms of making that happen. We just created a landlord survey We also have a work group going to address mental health and AODA concerns when somebody is experiencing homelessness and how we can help them stabilize in a safe environment. We have another work group that's just started to talk about how we can increase pathways to employment and engage employers into the conversation of addressing homelessness as well. So
a
some
lot
of those
happening
are
in the mix. Yes. Yeah. Lydia, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It was great to talk with you.
Lydia Van Thiel is Project Implementation Director for the Greater Green Bay Blueprint to Prevent and End Homelessness. We're producing a range of conversations about homelessness. Find more at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine new research on why low-income households drink more bottled water than higher-income earners and the effects of this consumption on women and inequality. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a bombastic instrument making its way across UW's campus.
We recently received a question from Elizabeth Renner of Madison. She asked us, through WPR's Wisconsin Project, why are tubas such a prominent part of the UW-Madison band? And why are they so popular in Wisconsin? WPR's Tim Peterson marched right down to the Madison campus to get some answers.
The tuba has a long and deep history in Wisconsin. In the mid-1800s, a lot of Germans immigrated to the area, bringing their music, their refreshments, and their instruments with them. That's according to John Stevens, a longtime tuba performer and composer in Wisconsin. He's also professor emeritus of music at UW-Madison.
The basic German culture of the state, I think, has a lot to do with it. Polka bands, bands and beer, if you will.
But the tuba and polka music really got oompa-pa-ing around the Civil War era. Military band music was popular, with big names in Wisconsin like the Broadhead Brass Band. Fast forward to today. The tuba is still very much alive and well, especially on UW's campus. Looking into the tuba questions made me want to know more about what it's like to be a tuba on Wisconsin football game days.
Before the game, we'll actually parade around the city and go to some of the different places on Regent Street and play right up close to the crowd there.
That's Gabe Kepke. He's a tuba player in the UW Marching Band. The iconic band dates back to 1885, just 2 decades after the end of the Civil War. It started as a military-style ensemble, a bit smaller than today's group. Another tuba player is Max Collins. He says the band has a protocol for how members are supposed to act in uniform, but as tubas...
We get to mess with people a little bit more. If we see fans in the opposing colors, we kind of just play at their face a little bit.
Then there's the pregame and halftime performances at Camp Randall.
We're so big, you can see the bell from anywhere in a stadium.
That's Joseph Klug, another UW tuba player.
I know other instruments, they have hats with massive plumes on them, and so you can clearly tell whenever they're looking around. For us, it's you can clearly tell if we're facing the wrong way.
Corey Pompey is the UW Marching Band Director and Associate Director of Bands at UW-Madison. He says the notes tubas play are the roots of every chord, the bass lines that everything else the band plays are built on.
It's just an important sound, an important voice in the band that we just have to have.
During game day performances, the tubas assert themselves with a couple of additional antics. One of Kepke's favorites is when the tuba section builds a human pyramid. And in a tradition going back to the 1950s, the tubas famously embark on a march around the field during the second half.
We play a version of On Wisconsin, that's all tuba. We also play a version of You Said It All, that's all tuba. So when we're going around and playing the melody for people, it's like, it makes you feel like a star. It's awesome.
Pompey agrees. Pompey also says he enjoys just being around the tubas. They're fun. They tell jokes. They don't take things too seriously.
I should also note that it's an extremely hard-working group of people. And you have to be in order to carry that heavy instrument around for as long as they do.
And they just have a special bond. Collins says it's something he loves about being a UW tuba.
All 20 of us pretty regularly kind of hang out. So having that many people that you're just close to just because you are really makes it feel like you belong somewhere and really makes you feel like a part of something.
So keep an eye out for this pack of rhinos, as they call themselves, next game day, especially if you're not wearing cardinal red and white.
WPR's Tim Peterson brought us that piece on tubas in Wisconsin. And that story idea came through WPR's Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future story. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Bottled water is supposed to be a temporary fix in a water quality emergency. But researchers find that women and recipients of federal food assistance are target markets for bottled water consumption. Call in with a question or comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Manny Teodoro is a professor at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. New research out on the relationships between bottled water, income, and gender. Manny, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate. Great to be with you.
Your report findings of relationships between gender and income and how a person consumes bottled water, what is emerging? What are you finding?
Yeah, it's fascinating. You know, bottled water consumption generally has been growing steadily in the United States over the last 25 years. But somewhat counterintuitively, bottled water consumption is inversely correlated with income. In other words, as people's income grows, their likelihood of drinking bottled water actually declines, which is surprising because bottled water is expensive. So bottled water consumption ends up being the highest among lowest income Americans. Even though on a unit cost basis, your water from your tap costs about a penny a gallon, water from bottles that you buy at a big box store costs something like $2 to $3 a gallon. So it's this ironically very expensive product that lower income people tend to buy. That's been well known now really for the last 10 years as researchers over and over again have found that correlation. The thing that's new here that's surprising is that that correlation seems to appear only for women or largely for women and not for men. We've got a raft of new consumer behavior surveys and data from the last 3 or 4 years that show a very steep correlation between income and bottled water consumption, or rather negative slope, declining likelihood for women, but virtually none at all for men. So it appears that this relationship between income and bottled water consumption is distinctly gendered.
And why might women and men perceive tap water safety quite differently?
Yeah, we don't really know. Decades of research on risk perception generally show that women tend to be much more risk averse than men on a whole wide variety of things, whether you're talking about something like recreational sports to health and safety kinds of questions. Women just tend to be more risk averse. Men are more risk tolerant. We know that one of the main reasons people drink bottled water is the perception that it's safer than what comes out of the tap. And so the best thing that we can guess here is that women perceive bottled water as safer than tap water, and they're more sensitive to that perception, particularly at lower incomes. What we think might be going on here is that as income increases, of course, income's also correlated with education, and that maybe women who have higher levels of education understand more clearly the relationships between between risk of bottled water and risk of tap water. And in general, for most of us, you know, tap water is just as safe, if not safer, than what comes out of a bottle.
I just want to pause here to acknowledge that communities that are poor, communities of color, you find are more likely to have drinking water problems, water utility problems. So how is bottled water connected to systemic racism and discrimination?
Yeah, no, that's an important point. Some of my past research has shown that in cases, of course, we know about the high profile cases like Flint, Michigan or Jackson, Mississippi. Mm-hmm. There are places where tap water failures are more likely to occur in places with very high non-white, very high poverty populations. And what we find is that those failures cause distrust generally across the country. So you might live in a community where the tap water is excellent, but if you're a member of a minority population or maybe part of a low-income group, part of what you perceive is that, hey, you know, a failure somewhere else for people who look like me, with whom I can identify, caused me to be less trustful of my or more distrustful of my own tap water. And unfortunately, the way that that ends up playing out is people with relatively low incomes end up spending a lot of money on bottled water. It's a phenomenon that economists call defensive spending. They believe that they're defending themselves from a health risk, whether or not that health risk actually exists.
Now, you also take a look at SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, finding that women on SNAP are more likely to drink bottled water than men using the program. What does this tell you about the trust in tap water among low-income women and how these benefits are being used?
Yeah, well, you know, it's just in some ways an extension of the thing I talked about a moment ago, which is that, you know, people who are on SNAP, which is, for those of you who remember out there, it's the old food stamps program, but now it's been renamed, rebranded SNAP. It's a food assistance program for low-income people. And what we see is that the women on SNAP are much, much more likely than men on SNAP to spend those SNAP benefits on bottled water. More than 50%. According to our data, more than 50% of women on SNAP drink primarily bottled water at home. So they're spending a great deal of resources on bottled water. One of the things that's striking about that is that bottled water is a SNAP eligible purchase. In other words, if you receive SNAP benefits, you can use those benefits to buy bottled water. Now, I'm in no way suggesting that that's bad. I think it's good to let people use those SNAP benefits to buy legitimate things. But it adds up. Mm. You know, a conservative estimate is that somewhere between $1 and $2 billion of federal funding every year through the SNAP program end up going to bottled water. So we're talking about a significant amount of money. Just to put things in perspective, the water bill assistance program that ran during the COVID pandemic from the federal government spent about $600 million, or maybe close to $1 billion by that time it's all done, over a two-year period. Well, 1 year of SNAP spending will probably more than double that on bottled water. So we have a federal water assistance program, but it's only going to bottled water.
Manny Teodoro, professor at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs, studying bottled water consumption, trust in public water works. You can join the conversation. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Researchers describe bottled water as lightly regulated and exponentially more expensive than tap water. We learn how bottled water consumption affects women and people living in poverty and hear from you. Call in with a question. Share your views. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Manny Teodoro is a professor at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs, studies the bottled water industry and water equity. Manny, when you are looking to try to get to reliable, safe water, enter toxic chemicals, PFAS, and contamination there. You have said that filtering through point of entry technology may be a sustainable answer. What sets this filtering technology apart from other forms of management of these forever chemical in our water systems?
Yeah, a point of entry technology, sometimes called point of entry treatment, is a promising thing, largely because of the what we're discovering about the distribution of risk of PFAS. I should start by saying this is an area of emerging research, so we're learning more about this stuff every day. But the more we study, the more it appears that the serious PFAS contamination is very intense, but very isolated. So it tends to be in smaller communities, smaller systems. You know, of course, in Wisconsin, we have a lot of smaller communities. And in Wisconsin, we have a lot of private well owners, a lot of people who rely on private wells. That's the kinds of places where we're finding the PFAS contamination is the worst. Well, it's very expensive to run a large-scale PFAS treatment for an entire, say, for an entire city, in order to treat a very small, isolated contamination site. So, point of entry treatment is a technology that treats or removes the PFAS contamination at the point where the water supply enters a home or enters a building. So the idea is that rather than treating an entire water supply that's used for everything from irrigation to firefighting, you just treat the water as it enters a home through filtration at the point where it enters the home. The technology seems to work pretty well in technical trials, but the challenge is maintenance, because a saturated saturated and expired filter is actually worse than no filter at all. So the challenge is maintenance. And there's some interesting testing going on right now to see how that might work.
And with point of entry, like how far up the chain in the water process would the filtration system be?
The idea here is that we would treat for most of the conventional kinds of contaminants the way we always have at a treatment plant microbial contamination or everything else. But the PFAS filtration would happen at the point where the water supply enters the home. That's why we've got the name point of entry treatment. So you've got a service line that connects your home or your building to the water main on the street. We would install a filter at the point where that water supply enters the home. The real promise here would be if we can develop ways for that point of entry to be completely accessible from the outside, so that maintenance workers can reach the point of entry filtration from the outside and handle maintenance and monitoring from that spot without a homeowner ever, without that person ever having to enter the home and disturb the homeowner.
Would that system have to be replicated for every housing unit?
Potentially, yes. In places where there's severe contamination, that's the idea. Now, I want to go back to the thing that I mentioned earlier. This is a technology that really only makes sense in places where contamination is severe.
Okay.
So there's a case in Washington State in a community called Yakima that's adjacent to a military base where they've got severe PFAS contamination. And this is the technology that they're employing there. It's really only an appropriate technology for situations with very severe PFAS contamination. But we do have a handful of those places in Wisconsin. And so it's a technology that's worth exploring here.
We're talking with Manny Teodoro, professor at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. You can join in the conversation. Questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Jane in Suamico. Jane, hi.
Hi. I have some concerns about what I'm hearing about PFAS in particular. Those POET systems, the point of entry filtration systems, we have to remember that those filters become hazardous waste. If they contain the PFAS after the filters have been filled, we need a way to destroy them or store them so they don't go in a landfill and become part of contaminating more land with PFAS. And the other thing I think is really important to understand is the PFAS is leaking into the Bay of Green Bay through places like Marinette and Peshtigo from the northern part of the state. And the Bay of Green Bay is part of the Lake Michigan, which is part of the Great Lakes. And that's 90% of the fresh water in the United States. It is not a small problem.
Jane, thank you. Manny, your thoughts?
Yes, I want to start by saying Jane is absolutely right on the disposal question with filtration. It's one of the real challenges with point of entry treatment because, as I said earlier, it's maintenance and implementation, maintenance of this technology. When you've got a filter that's saturated with PFAS, what you're doing is, in fact, you know, as Jane suggested, you're kind of holding a bundle of hazardous waste. Yeah, you can't just stick it in the trash can, which is why you need to have professional maintenance, professional servicing of these units in order to dispose of that filtration media properly. It, for folks who aren't familiar with PFAS, disposal is one of the most serious challenges. These are chemical compounds that were designed to be difficult to destroy. And in fact, they are difficult to destroy. So, yeah, she's absolutely right. And you know, as far as the scale of the issue with respect to the Great Lakes, I don't really have much to say. I don't really know that area of the issue. But yeah, this question of how to deal with filtration is one of the main challenges, maybe the main challenge with point of entry treatment.
I want to circle back for a moment to restoring trust in tap water. And in fact, we have less than a minute left. But is there anything policymakers can do to help build trust in the safety of tap water?
There's a lot of things that policymakers can do, and we could spend a whole other hour on it. But given the time we've got left, I'll say the single most important thing that we can do is have excellent tap water for everyone, everywhere. One of the surprising findings of some research I did with a couple of co-authors over the last few years is this idea that distrust of tap water is contagious. You could, as I mentioned earlier in this conversation, you could be living in a community with excellent tap water, but if you see a failure down the road, across the country in a high profile case, you could come to distrust your own tap water. And so it's really ensuring that tap water is excellent for everyone all the time.
Manny, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a delight, Kate.
Manny Teodoro is a professor at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.